This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear excerpts from an event sponsored by the Center for Constitutional Rights at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, From Pinochet to Rumsfeld, Accountability of U.S. Officials for Torture. We'll hear from several speakers, including Janice Karpinski, former U.S. commanding officer at Abu Ghraib Prison, our own co-host Michael Ratner, as well as a doctor who, in her work with torture victims, provides rare insight into the long-term effects of torture. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
In the wake of the Center for Constitutional Rights' groundbreaking filing of war crimes charges against Donald Rumsfeld, this CCR event aimed to examine different strategies for holding international officials accountable for their actions. We'll hear an exploration of the devastating effects of torture techniques employed by the U.S. government. It's certainly not for the faint of heart, but important in beginning to understand how torture, used in the name of the people of the United States, must end immediately. We'll now hear from Janice Karpinski, former U.S. commanding officer at Abu Ghraib Prison in Iraq. Karpinski served 25 years in the Army and Reserves. She was promoted and then sent to command the military police, responsible for handling prisoners at Abu Ghraib.
I, too, would like to thank all of you for your interest and the Center for Constitutional Rights for allowing me to participate. I am not a lawyer. I'm not an attorney. Man, have I been studying the law over the last couple of years. I was a soldier, and I will always be a soldier. I spent part of my lifetime doing what I enjoyed doing and taking care of soldiers. And I can tell you that I saw things in Iraq I never would have believed and still have trouble believing, witnessing some of the failures of leaders I trusted and thought I could respect, who became far more interested in their political ambitions than they were in their military leadership responsibilities. I am continuing to speak out. I will not be silenced. I feel empowered by seeking the truth, and it is what I am interested in. I have been condemned, called a traitor, and by people who I consider the failures in this situation and in this administration. We have yet to hold them fully accountable, as Scott mentioned, and we need to. I've said from the beginning, from the very first investigation, when I thought that the military justice system would be fair and would prevail, I told General Taguba, hold me accountable for what I could control. Don't hold me accountable or responsible for things that I was not aware of and was never participating in. But he was set on a course. He was determined to make the Secretary of Defense and General Sanchez happy with the results. He never served in Iraq. He spent his tour in Kuwait. So you have a person who doesn't understand what a soldier feels like, having their life on the line and threatened 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, investigating this in the comfort of an air-conditioned conference room, as if you could duplicate the situation. But he had the conclusion before he pursued the investigation. On a timeline, it's very clear to me, we were given a new mission when I arrived in Iraq. It was to restore the entire prison system for all of Iraq. Soldiers who finished their mission of prisoner of war operations very honorably and successfully and were preparing to go home were held hostage, as they've said to me many times, and said, not so fast, you're going to do this mission now. So it was a complete mind shift for them. And we established 17 prison facilities for Iraq and processed over 40,000 Iraqi prisoners, criminal prisoners, through our system. When Major General Miller was sent to Iraq in September of 2003, he stayed for 12 days and everything changed. He did not work with me or my military police personnel. He worked with the commander of the military intelligence, he worked with the interrogators, and he worked with General Sanchez's military intelligence officer, General Fast. And he taught them new techniques, approved techniques for interrogation involving torture, abuse, and humiliation. But General Miller said under oath to the Senate Armed Services Committee, I was not assigned to Iraq. I had no authority in Iraq. So I could not possibly have given them orders to change the way they were doing their mission. The day General Miller left Iraq to go back to Guantanamo Bay, he stopped for a week in Washington, D.C. to speak to the Secretary of Defense and Dr. Stephen Cambone about his successful undertaking in Iraq. And then he proceeded back to Guantanamo Bay. And he was informed on a daily basis of the results of the interrogations taking place at Abu Ghraib. He never discussed any of those things with me. The interrogators certainly never discussed any of their procedures with me. And in fact, before General Miller left Iraq, he said he was going to make Abu Ghraib the interrogation center for all of Iraq. And in less than 2 months' time, even though he had no authority in Iraq, he successfully accomplished the transition. And he directed General Sanchez to turn the responsibility for Abu Ghraib over to the military intelligence interrogators. And he did that. General Sanchez, under oath to the Senate Armed Services Committee, denied any knowledge of the photographs or the activities depicted in the photographs. Yet his signature was placed on an 8-page memorandum authorizing an entire litany of interrogation and torture techniques to include the use of dogs with his specific permission. And his signature was on the memorandum. His testimony, when he was asked about it after the Senate Armed Service Committee investigation, his statement was, but that memorandum was retracted. Well, they forgot to tell some of the soldiers that were still adhering to that memorandum, apparently. General Sanchez is retired from the Army now. General Miller is retired from the Army now. The Secretary of Defense, who condemned anybody who thought about cutting and running, as he said, managed to cut and run himself by submitting his resignation. But we have thousands of soldiers who have given their lives. We have 30,000 soldiers who have come back permanently disfigured or disabled. And we're, instead of spending money on veterans and healing them, we're pouring more money and more soldiers into the fight in Iraq and this illegal occupation. I found out about the investigation in January, an ongoing investigation in January of 2004. I didn't find out about it from anybody in my chain of command. I found out about it from the commander of the Criminal Investigation Division, who sent me a 3-sentence email informing me about the ongoing investigation in very, very general terms. But he mentioned photographs without mentioning any details. So we left our location the very next morning and drove down, we convoyed down three vehicles down to Abu Ghraib to find out what this investigation was all about. And it was no surprise, but nobody knew anything. Or they were told not to discuss it with anybody. And to them, that meant me as well. They were not under my command any longer. The prison was under the control of the military intelligence. But I was very concerned about this reference to an ongoing investigation and photographs. And it was not until 2 weeks later when I saw the photographs for the first time. There was no discussion about this investigation. There was no discussion about these photographs before then, not from General Sanchez, not from anybody. It was this very strange, eerie silence. So when I saw the first time, I saw the first 15 photographs that most of you have seen around the world in April of 2004, I was shocked. I was absolutely sickened by what I was seeing. I couldn't believe that soldiers would be participating in anything like this. But there were more people than 7 or 8 military police soldiers in any of those photographs. I asked about, what about the other ones? And what in the world were the translators doing around the prisoners? It was the first time that I learned that some of the military intelligence interrogators seen in those photographs, they'd already been allowed to go back to the United States in anticipation of a problem, perhaps. And those translators in the photographs, those contract translators, were not translators at all, but they were contract interrogators who had been sent to Iraq by Major General Miller. Remember, the man who didn't have any authority? After they were practiced and seasoned and developed an expertise at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. I was in disbelief that any of my soldiers or any soldier would be involved in such practices. I couldn't understand what they were thinking. And I've never had a chance to speak to any one of those soldiers because, as I was told by General Sanchez's and the most senior JAG officer, legal officer in Iraq, when I tried to get in to see each one of those soldiers, they were being held at a separate location, I was told I had no right to speak to any of them because they did not work for me. They worked for the military intelligence commander. So you can imagine that I was again surprised in April, when it hit the media outlets, that I am the only name being used in conjunction with those soldiers' behavior and those photographs. I think that it's very interesting today, in 2007, with the ongoing trial now of Scooter Libby, that his defense is that he's a scapegoat. And everybody seems to be shaking their head north and south in understanding of that, to include the vice president. But when it was clearly Janice Karpinski being used as a scapegoat, they dismissed it as being ridiculous, that this was simply, as Scott said, 7 bad apples out of control on the night shift, and a female who was trying to be a commander. They tried to tie it up into a very nice little package from the very beginning and dismiss us all as the reason for this. And as I've said before, and the comment earlier in the introduction, it was never about the activities depicted in the photographs. It was about the existence of photographs, because those photographs picked up the curtain on what was going on with interrogation and torture in prison facilities and secret facilities throughout the world, not just Abu Ghraib. So the photographs lifted that veil of secrecy. This is not in any way, shape, or form limited to 7 low-ranking soldiers or a female brigadier general. This is big, much bigger. It involves the people at the very top of our nation's government, and they have managed to avoid and escape any blame or responsibility whatsoever. And if we allow this to happen, this becomes a tragedy of unforeseen proportions. Thank you very much.
That was Janice Karpinski, former U.S. commanding officer at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. We'll now hear from Kate Porterfield, a doctor specializing in child and family treatment, bereavement, and loss in families. She spoke to the long-term effects of torture survivors and documents the health consequences of torture.
My name is Kate Porterfield, and I'm a political psychologist at the Bellevue NYU Program for Survivors of Torture. And I've been invited tonight to speak about the effects of torture on individuals who survive that kind of condition. Just before I begin, I want to thank CCR and the Nation for inviting me this evening, and also for our ongoing collaboration that we've been doing over these last couple years on the work with particularly detainees in Guantanamo. Very brief history of the work we do, because I think it will help put a context on what I'm going to talk about with you. The Program for Survivors of Torture has been in existence for the last about 11 years at Bellevue Hospital and NYU School of Medicine. Our program was founded by our director, who I think is here tonight. There he is, Dr. Alan Keller. Alan, give a wave, please. I do want to acknowledge, because Dr. Keller, thank you. As the founder of this program, designed it after coming to the realization that in the emergency rooms around New York, and particularly in Bellevue, we were seeing many individuals coming from war zones and places in which they were experiencing the kind of persecution and torture that at that point many doctors sort of only imagined happened in movies and in other places not so close to home. I think the last several years for us have been particularly painful as we've realized that our work and our consultation has been drawn upon for torture and maltreatment that's taken place on American watch all around the world. And so that's been a particularly painful, but we hope, fruitful collaboration with CCR and other human rights organizations. So I want to talk to you a little bit briefly about the psychological effects of torture. And I actually don't want to talk a lot about symptoms and syndromes and things like that. I want to talk more phenomenologically with you about simply what it means to be a person who has this experience and then what difficulties it later causes you. So to think about that a little, I actually think before you think about, well, what does torture do to a person, it's helpful to think about what are the goals of torture, because that will actually lead you, I think, down the road to imagining what it's like to survive it. I think when you think about torture and sort of the myths that have been debunked about it, we've talked about them already tonight. One is that torture, the goal of it is information gathering. Well, a lot of people have spoken already about this. That's really been proven not true, and that in fact the information coming out of torture is often quite faulty and dangerous, and sort of has a threshold effect, meaning anything, once you get someone to a point of suffering that's at a certain level, they'll tell you anything you want to hear. So I think that the goal of torture as information gathering is probably not such an accurate description. And in fact, we think about the goals of torture as twofold. The first is that torture is designed to send a message to a community of people. It may be done to an individual, but it sends a message to a community based on race, ethnicity, religion, political involvement, social involvement, sexual orientation, gender, whatever. And the message is one about that community's essential lack of value, lack of worth, and ultimately lack of power and control. So again, we're thinking now effects. What might the effect be of having that message sent through you to your community, to the place that you belong, that you are worthless, valueless, and without any power? By the way, this makes it also a very public phenomenon, torture, right? This message sending, because it's not just that it's sent to you as an individual, but because you're going back ultimately to your community, the message becomes public. The second goal of torture, if the first is to send a message, is really to dehumanize. And we've heard this tonight in a number of ways. The idea to dehumanize a person, literally to take away someone's humanity, again, think about what that might mean for a person, for their psychological well-being and functioning, to erase somebody's essence, to in fact sort of take away the thing that connects us to each other, that's our humanity. So these two points, these two goals, right, the sending of a message to a community about its powerlessness and worthlessness, and the taking away of one's essential connection in humanity, lead to a particular set of problems in people who survive torture. So what are these problems? What are these effects? Well, first of all, there are physical effects, obviously. I'm not going to really be able to go into them right now. That's not the purview of this conversation. And in fact, Dr. Keller's done extensive clinical work and research on the physical effects of torture. There's an entire range of things physically that happen to people who are put in these kinds of situations, everything from soft tissue injury to traumatic brain injury to STDs to burns and much, much more. But what about the psychological? Psychological injuries are in some ways more difficult to assess and recognize. These are the ways that the torture experience stays in the person's emotional, cognitive, interpersonal reality, right? The way that the torture stays with them in some way. These effects can be longer lasting, harder to describe, and fundamentally, in some ways, harder to heal. Now, there's a couple major diagnoses that you usually hear about in someone who's been tortured, and I will share them with you. But I do, before I talk diagnosis, want to again think about just human experience. And I think that the best way to understand how these diagnoses, what they mean and what they come from, is to think that the experience of being tortured is characterized by two fundamental human experiences, the experience of fear and the experience of despair. So when you are tortured, when you live through the kinds of things that people are living through in these situations all around the world, first you live with an intolerable amount of fear. The torture situation is one of profound unpredictability. There are extremes all around you of treatment, temperature, light, human behavior, good cop, bad cop. There's a complete dislocation of you from time, disorientation, constant threats, pain being evoked, violence. A constant state of fear is evoked in the person who's being tortured. And this leads to central nervous system arousal, which in fact then leads to this diagnosis that you hear about called post-traumatic stress disorder. So yes, PTSD is a common diagnosis in someone who survives torture, but I would like you to take away tonight the idea that fear and terror are what lead someone to have these symptoms of this syndrome that we call PTSD. What does PTSD look like? It involves intrusive memories, inescapable reliving of bad events, flashbacks, nightmares, an exaggerated startle response, feelings of anxiety as if the torture is occurring again right now. That's the kind of fear end of the spectrum for a survivor of torture. What about the other end of the spectrum, despair? Again, what is the torture situation have that evokes despair? You've heard it much more articulately from two people who've survived here and a third who's going to be speaking in a moment. But in this experience of torture, someone experiences a lack of control, a feeling of being trapped, being degraded and humiliated, and made to feel that you will never be able to escape. These qualities of a torture situation lead to feelings then of helplessness and hopelessness. What does that sound like in diagnostic terms? Depression. So when you think about the despair experience of being tortured and you think about the effect of that, you end up thinking about something that looks a lot like what we think of as depression, low mood, sadness, tearfulness, feeling worthless, disconnection and apathy, and feelings of guilt and shame. So I just want to say briefly that when you think about the effects of torture, and I've tried to frame them here in this idea of the fear experience and the despair experience, there are ways that people can recover and rebuild after torture. How does this happen? Well, if the person gets an opportunity, and I underscore the word opportunity, to get help, to reconnect and get treatment, then they may be able to recover from these kinds of very severe events. Many of the people you're hearing about tonight will not get that opportunity, or certainly haven't up until this point. What does someone need to repair and recover from torture? First, they need a safe environment, a place that is no longer full of danger, unpredictability, and threat. They need to have their basic human needs met: food, health, roof over their heads, well-being. Then, when those basic human needs have been met, the person may be able to, in the context of a good place, a good treatment place, be able to rebuild in the face of this fear and this despair. In our clinic, we believe that the two components to that are that the answer to despair is a reconnecting in sort of the most basic human terms, human connection that happens in the presence of another person bearing witness to what you went through. That can look like a therapist who meets you every week and hears what you went through and listens, who helps you tolerate those memories, who provides you with psychoeducation about what you're experiencing and why you're feeling this way, and who lets you release some of the emotions inside of you. That's human connection. That's what we believe is the answer to the despair. The answer to the fear is what we like to simply call hope, which is working with that person in the setting to rebuild and help them look forward rather than have to look back in fear and intensive, overwhelming memories. So what I want to end with is just to say to you this, that whatever symptoms a person has after torture, whatever condition or syndrome they have, and there are many, flashbacks, nightmares, anxiety, avoidance of memories, emotional numbing, dissociation, depression, hopelessness, suicidality, whatever symptoms they have, it's important we remember those as human reactions to an experience of intense fear and intense despair that was brought about by other human beings. That is the essence of torture.
That was Kate Porterfield, PhD, specializing in child and family treatment and documenting the effects of long-term torture.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Love, there are flowers hanging in the vine, so high you cannot see. My mind must go on holiday, torn from its hook, a broken valentine. I see the smoke from a revolver. Will I get hit? I hardly care. When I'm bombed, I stretch like bubblegum and look too long straight at the morning sun. Love, there are flowers along the avenue, all things perfectly in place. I build a shrine, I set a monument, because you're fire, because you're a fire escape.
We go now to hear from Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee of the New York Bar Association.
Good evening, and I want to thank the Center for Constitutional Rights in the Nation for the opportunity to address you tonight. I think throughout our history, we've had great leaders and we've had doubtful leaders. And it's important on occasions like this to recall the words of some of our country's great and inspirational leaders. And that's how I'd like to start, by reading you a few words that are addressed to the question of respect for the law of war, proper treatment of prisoners, and what to do when those in our government and our military fail to heed these rules. Should any American soldier be so base and infamous as to injure any prisoner, I do most earnestly enjoin you to bring him to the most severe and exemplary punishment as the enormity of the crime itself may require. Should it extend to death itself, that may not be excessive given the gravity of the matter and the cause involved. Any leader or officer who tolerates the abuse, who fails to punish the abuse, brings shame and disgrace, brings ruin upon our country and himself. This we will never tolerate. I read to you the words of the first George W., George Washington, issued his standing orders to the Army in 1776. For those who think that the tradition of humane treatment of prisoners is a new issue, America has had a long and honorable tradition in this area. In fact, to a large extent, it was, as was noted recently by David Hackett Fisher in his novel Washington's Crossing, this was a defining doctrine not only for the American military, for the American Army, which is the oldest American institution, older than our Constitution, our courts, our presidency, older than the Continental Congress. It was also a defining notion for our country. And it was critical to the success that was achieved by the Founding Fathers and by the American Army in the Revolutionary War. So this country arose from a tradition of treating prisoners in war situations correctly. Now, in the global war on terror, war crimes have been committed, very serious war crimes. In that respect, it frankly is no different from any other war our nation has engaged in. War crimes are always committed. They're an inescapable fact of war. What is distinctive about this war? That those war crimes follow directly from policies that were adopted at the highest level of the government. It's not a matter of a handful of rotten apples failing to heed the rule. It's not a matter simply of bad morale and discipline. And indeed, at the end of the day, if it's true that this shame and disgrace that's been brought to our country is to be put at the feet of a handful of rotten apples, then it's clear that that handful of rotten apples is not at the bottom of the chain of command, but at the top. So I want to talk about this question of accountability and bringing to justice. And I think we need to all start with a recognition that this is a process that may last a very long time. And I ask all of you to be resolved, determined, and uncompromising. It's only in this way that we will bring about justice. And I think what we seek here is not solely justice for the victims. We seek justice for our country and for the vindication of our traditions. This administration has put up a fog around its policies from the beginning. It has attempted to obscure its conduct. How many times have we seen the President of the United States state, "We do not torture"? And every time you hear that statement, you all have to make this mental amendment. We do not torture. Footnote, torture as we define torture, which means exactly what we want it to mean and nothing else. Because as torture has been defined historically by the United States, and as torture is defined by the world community, we have introduced a consistent practice of torture. We introduced it into the military and into the intelligence service operations. That was done as a result of executive decision, yes, by the decider himself. And we know where this idea started, because indeed very few ideas start with the decider. We know that this started in the office of Vice President Dick Cheney. We know he lobbied it and he pushed it aggressively. And indeed, I think if any of you have any doubts about that, I suggest you look at an interview that John McCain gave yesterday in which he talked about this process and very squarely laid the blame on Vice President Dick Cheney as the author of these policies and as the person who lobbied them through to the end. He had many allies in this administration in the process, allies who realized where the real center of power was in the administration. And who was pushing policy for the global war on terror. And that certainly included the man who is now the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. But it also included the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, a number of Rumsfeld's senior assistants in the Department of Defense, a number of senior figures in the Department of Justice, and others throughout the government. Well, we now have the paper trail. We have a large part of it. I think in the course of the next year, the Judiciary Committee, the Armed Services Committee are going to be extracting a lot more of that paper trail, and we're going to see a lot more detail about who was involved and what decisions were taken. And the papers that remain to be produced, to the extent anyone has any doubt that there's any connection between the abusive techniques that we saw in Abu Ghraib, that we saw in Guantanamo, at Bagram Air Base, and the policies that were fixed. There are, in fact, specific memoranda that link these things. And these memoranda, I predict, in the course of the next year, are going to make it onto the front page of the New York Times. I certainly hope they will. In any event, we now know they exist. Now, the administration's response to all of this has been what? To appoint an independent prosecutor and conduct an investigation? No. Its response has been to have a series of not quite ever overlapping military investigations, each of which is expressly charged to look only down the chain of command and not up it. So the result, the only possible result of that process was the inculpation of and the bringing of charges against relatively low-ranking officers and the grunts. And to the extent people have been held to account today, and we have had 36 court-martials so far, and there are others pending and ready to go, we are talking about, for the most part, junior officers, and we're talking about mid- and lower-level enlisted personnel. I'm not objecting to that. I'm saying that may very well be appropriate, but the real wrongdoing here, the most egregious wrongdoing, the wrongdoing that's most offensive to our dignity as a country, is by the policymakers. And the administration's response there has been what? Not to investigate. It's been to give itself a preemptive pardon. And that was done in the dark days of the last Congress, which was, I think, ranked in public opinion as the most disreputable in the last 100 years, to enact a piece of legislation called the Military Commissions Act of 2006. And I think most of us got upset about many aspects of this. There's one, of course, is the decision that to strip away the right of habeas corpus, right? And that they attempted to do. In fact, only last week we had the Attorney General go before the Judiciary Committee and explain that there is no constitutional right of habeas corpus at all. That's a figment of our imagination. The Attorney General should read the first inaugural address of Thomas Jefferson, in which he'll see it was also a figment of the imagination of the Founding Fathers as well. And we also have a definition of unlawful enemy combatant, in which, by some constructions, any of us could be made an unlawful enemy combatant and thereby stripped of all legal rights, not just constitutional rights, and held completely subject to the whim of the president, which would be the very definition of the term tyranny. But no, beyond all of those things, there are a series of technical amendments in which the War Crimes Act itself is amended, defenses are introduced, and the purpose of all of these amendments is to shield officers of this administration from prosecution for war crimes. Very clear purpose. The president went out and said, I'm doing this to protect the interrogators here who otherwise face risk of prosecution. I'm not going to get into all the technical details. I will tell you, that's bullshit. Only one class of people who were clearly exposed under the War Crimes Act, and those people are political appointees holding high office in Washington. So they are presumptively protected by this statute. Are they in fact protected? Do they have repose? Well, I'll just note a few things here. Does anybody know what the statute of limitations for war crimes is? There is none. There's a very good reason for that. There is no statute of limitations. And if there was an attempt here to grant immunity, to pardon war crimes by an administration, the administration pardoning itself, is that ultimately effective as a matter of law? I think we should all just leave that question out there hanging. I know in my heart what the answer is. But I know as a matter of international law, and this is a law that was articulated by the United States when the government of Slobodan Milosevic attempted this maneuver. The United States said, not only is that not effective, we'll take that as evidence of mens rea and guilt by the people who attempted it. That's an example to be looked at very closely by the balance of the international community and by American governments to follow. Thank you.
That was Scott Horton, Chair of the International Law Committee, New York Bar Association. We'll now hear from our own Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I went to Germany to file the case with Wolfgang in November. And we filed it from a theater called the Babylon Theater, which would have been in Old East Berlin. And it was a site, actually, a historic site in East Germany, where anti-fascists fought against Hitler and were eventually, of course, liquidated. But it's one of the most historic theaters in Berlin. And when we got there, we were shocked. First, on the marquee, it had a big words, human rights against Rumsfeld, which was a great feeling. Then there were 150 press in the room, and I compared it to when we filed 2 years earlier, when we, you know, there were some press, but nothing like this. And of course, it was a couple of days after Rumsfeld resigned, and I remember reading the entire New York Times, 6 pages of material on Rumsfeld and the Iraq War, and not a word about his implementation of the torture practices and program of the United States. After we filed this case, there is no one who thinks about Rumsfeld who doesn't think about him as one of the people who involved in setting up the torture program. So in my view, the case already is quite successful. It was an amazing moment. Janice Karpinski was with us, and one of the reporters said to her, which is true for Rumsfeld as well, you know, you could be arrested by the German authorities right now for your role, if they think there's one, in the Abu Ghraib torture. And she said, well, I've come because I really believe that we have to bring the higher-ups to justice. And they continue, the German government, of course, to think that she could be arrested or, and this is the good part, that if Donald Rumsfeld decides to go to Germany, he is taking a very high risk. The theory The theory of universal jurisdiction is that there should never be a safe haven for a torturer, nowhere in the world. And once you file a case like this in Germany, there could be even today an arrest warrant issued that is secret, that Rumsfeld doesn't know about, that we don't know about, that would be good all over Europe. So he is not going to be traveling out of his incredibly sad plantation, Mount Misery, which is, you know what it's called, and taking a trip to Europe very soon. Now, as Wolfgang said, we don't know how it's going to unfold in Germany. In my view, it's been successful so far. It's labeled Rumsfeld what he is, a torturer. It has made it unsafe for him to travel, and it has actually electrified, really, the movement of holding these U.S. officials responsible. Because without holding them accountable, we will see torture continue to unroll and unroll. And it's not a question, as even you hear the Democrats say sometimes, looking forward. You have to look backward. You have to hold these guys accountable, there will not be a time when the next country in the world doesn't say, you guys did it when you had an act of terror against it. We can do it too. And the only way you can say, no, you can't, is by holding people like Donald Rumsfeld responsible. So I consider it an amazingly historic occasion. Wolfgang has been an incredible lawyer, along with the other lawyers we've worked with in Europe, as well as the human rights organizations. And it's as Wolfgang said, we can't say what will happen in Germany. We don't know what the process will be. But I can tell you this, whatever happens in Germany, there are other places, other countries, where we can go and pursue the Donald Rumsfelds of the world. I want to just, in a couple of minutes, also say a word about Guantanamo. You know, this afternoon I actually did something I don't often do, but I went to a high school and we showed the Arar video that you saw. And every time I see the Arar video, I break down and cry immediately when I see that moment when he just can't go on speaking. And really, over the 5 years that we've been dealing with Guantanamo, I mean, that's what it's really like. That's really what we are doing to human beings. And when you see Hassan's story, here's this guy, innocent of anything, and he winds up possibly having to live the rest of his life far from home, far from his family, far from anything he's familiar with in Albania. And you know, we've passed the fifth anniversary of Guantanamo, January 11th, 2002. And there were worldwide demonstrations to shut down Guantanamo, and to not just shut down Guantanamo and send people to another offshore penal colony, but to shut down Guantanamo and to have a world without any, and the United States without any, offshore penal colonies. And one of the things we did for that, we went to Washington, and we had a press conference, and then there was a demonstration. And I don't know if any of the people are here who were very active in that, Witness Against Torture. They come out of the Catholic Workers, and they played an extraordinary role of bringing to the streets the message of Guantanamo. And Gita Gutierrez and I were at that press conference, and then we walked from the Supreme Court to the federal court, and we walked in a line of 200 or 250 people who were hooded in orange jumpsuits with their hands tied behind our back. And for Gita in particular, but for me as well, we just watched that line marching through the streets of Washington. And we cried, because that is what our United States is doing to people, not just in Guantanamo, but all over the world. And then we said, how can this be the country that we are living in? But sadly it is. And I remember when we first took the Guantanamo cases that January 11th and decided to represent the first people, there were nobody, really a handful of people, who would go with us. The hate mail, and I remember describing it today at the high school, that we got were hundreds. You know, Michael, take your kids to Guantanamo and let them be eaten by the Taliban. You know, go be a prison guard. I mean, really tremendous hate mail. And the way things have changed, and my optimism comes out of not just the reaction to the Rumsfeld case, but to something that happened very recently. First, as you all know, we have 600 lawyers now from huge firms in this country, small firms, Christians, Jews, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, all representing Guantanamo detainees. It's an extraordinary It shouldn't be underestimated. It's an extraordinary legal chapter in the history of this country that those people understood the importance of the writ of habeas corpus. And when you see Arar or when you see Hassam, you realize, yes, they were tortured, but you also realize, had there been a process by which they could have gone to court and said, government, you've got the wrong guy, they wouldn't have been in those situations. Just tells you how important habeas corpus is. So my optimism is not just that we have the 600, but you also saw the statement by Stimson recently, Cully Stimson, the guy who is in charge of, no less, detainee policy in the United States, the clients at Guantanamo. And he said, he's the one who attacked the lawyers. He read the list of 14 major law firms, and he said two things about them. He said, one is, where are they getting their money from, implying that they might be getting, quote, terrorist money. And then secondly, he said, what about the firms that are paying the fees for other cases, whether it's Lockheed or whatever the firms are representing, and maybe they ought to know that the firms that they are paying are representing terrorists, and maybe they ought to think about taking their business elsewhere. Well, you would think, you know, and then he read the list of 14 names. You know, there's only one person that reminds you of Joe McCarthy reading a list of communist names, alleged communist names. The reaction was extraordinary. You know, we have a listserv where we have the 600 attorneys. No one faltered. Everyone was outraged. And as a result, Stimson, quote, apologized. This was their policy. This wasn't an aberration. It was their policy. But the 600 lawyers stood strong and tough. And it's actually what gives me some hope here. It's been a Sisyphean struggle. You know, we've rolled that stone up twice to the Supreme Court, and twice the Bush administration has, even though we've won, pushed it back on us. But I do think there are reasons that people are finally understanding that what we're doing in this country is violating the most fundamental rights that have been with a lot of us, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, really since 1215 in terms of habeas corpus. In one way, and this is the way I'll really end, we're at a turning point in this country. We can either decide we're not going to go forward as not just a vice president of torture, but as a country of torture, or a country of indefinite detention, or a country of special trials. What our role is and our goal, and not just through the lawsuits at the center and the activist work we do, but that all of us have to do, is to extirpate, get rid of, hold accountable anyone who was involved at those upper levels with regard to torture, indefinite detention, or special trials. Otherwise, we don't have a country any longer that I would say is a country we can be at all proud of living in any respect. Thank you.
Folks, I want you to stay with us just for a few more minutes. This is really one of the key portions of the program. 10 years ago, Radovan Karadzic wrote a letter to the judge in the context of the suit that the Center for Constitutional Right did. And in his letter, he said, he asked the judge, can you really hope to find truth or do justice to or protect people's rights, people who live in distant nations? And I think the panel here answered the question in an affirmative, absolutely, yes, we can. I'd like to thank very much this panel for being up here. Thank you.
For more information about the Center for Constitutional Rights War Crimes Complaint against former U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, visit ccr-ny.org. We'll also have a link to that on lawanddisorder.org.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.